All right, we're back for another edition of the Week in Review. We've got a ton of Murdoch news to update you. This crime and corruption saga just keeps rolling. We've got Liz Farrell, our executive editor and the co-host of the Murdoch Murders podcast, in the studio to help us break down all the happenings in this ongoing saga. We've got a major development in the fentanyl epidemic in South Carolina. There is a surge of overdoses that we covered exclusively on Fitz News this week. We've got a major shakeup at the South Carolina State House and a showdown at the Port of Charleston that could have national implications. All these stories and more coming your way on The Week in Review. So once again, this week, we're starting with the Murdoch Murders crime and corruption saga. This story just continues to fascinate readers across the state, across the country, continues to dominate the news cycle. And this week, we had several major developments in this case. We're going to start with the announcement of indictments, criminal charges against Alec Murdoch, the 53-year-old attorney who's at the heart of this mushrooming saga, but also for the first time, a co-conspirator, an attorney out of Beaufort, South Carolina, named Corey Fleming. Now, regular readers of Fitz News are familiar with Corey Fleming. He was one of the attorneys in the Satterfield case, which was the first case which sort of exposed the alleged criminality related to settlement scams that Alec Murdoch and his network were involved in, allegedly. Fleming is a lawyer who has been tied with Murdoch. They go way back, went to school together, law school together, practiced together for a long time, worked on any number of cases together. But the Satterfield case was the one that first drew the public's attention to this relationship. Now, there are several other cases in which Fleming and Murdoch have worked together, but the indictments that were announced this week revolve around the Satterfield case. Now, our executive editor, Liz Farrell, has been driving the coverage on this for the last few months. She has been focusing on these indictments, on the very latest criminal charges. Liz is in the studio with us now. She's going to tell us a little bit more about Corey Fleming and about the charges that were filed against him this week. What you got, Liz?
Well, I'll start with who Corey Fleming is. He is from Beaufort, like you said. And around Beaufort, he is really well-liked and seen around town a lot. And a lot of people know him. And today in his bond hearing, his attorney was, you know, trying to paint the picture that he was a family man. And I think typically when you hear that, you know, you're sort of like, of course he was, sure. But with Corey, he really was, or is, I guess I should say. I think in Beaufort, it was very shocking for people once it became clear that Corey might have been involved in this. And I think, you know, I'll start with it also, actually, the pattern of this. So it's kind of one of those things where it's like wherever you see Alec and Corey together in a case in which the Murdochs are involved in, perhaps, you do have to, it raises suspicions at this point because it seems kind of like one of their plays, I would say. So with the Satterfields, what happened was Alec had recommended Corey to the family of his housekeeper who died in the trip and fall accident. And, you know, there's a lot of technicalities here because essentially Corey, was supposed to represent their interests. Instead, he was representing Alec's interests. And I think admittedly so, from what I'm hearing from sources, that he is openly admitting to, doing it to help Alec and not necessarily the kids. But what they did was this sort of trick, I would say. They got a guy named Chad Westendorf, and last week you guys saw the depositions that we ran in Fitz News and we talked about on the podcast.
He's the vice president of the Palmetto State Bank, which was another cog in this alleged criminal operation.
Yeah, and it's important to note, Creighton Water said today during the hearing, he's the assistant attorney general or the prosecutor on the case, and he had noted that, you know, without Corey Fleming, none of this could have happened. And that's kind of the truth of all the players here. Without Chad, this couldn't have happened the way it happened. Without, Judge Carmen Mullen, this couldn't have happened the way it happened. So with Corey, I guess Tony Satterfield, who was the son of Gloria, started asking too many questions. So they got Chad, they put him on the case. Chad served as a personal representative, and he effectively became the client for Corey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you look at the technicality of that, Corey is now viewing Chad as his client. So he doesn't have to communicate with the Satterfields technically, but morally, ethically, of course. Why are you doing this otherwise? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're finding out. So why are they doing this otherwise? Corey was charged with 18 counts. This was a 44-page indictment, a superseding indictment, because it actually also replaces charges that Alec had previously received. So Alec went into this this week with 9 charges related to the Satterfield case out of the 70. Lord have mercy. There's so many charges.
72, I think.
Yeah, 72 cases. Yeah, 72 charges related to the financial crimes, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So now he has 4 additional charges. So Alec is charged with 13 counts related to the Gloria Satterfield case, but Corey has 18. So he's almost coming out of this worse for the wear. Mm-hmm. And the two are now charged with criminal conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And I find that, you know, interesting. It's now kind of ups the ante, right?
Is sure.
that sort of, you know, I know with federal cases, when you're talking about RICO and things like that, that's what you're looking for, right? That's
it
like
is.
The gateway into, you know, sort of the umbrella for all the other crimes. Yeah, there's a lot of charges, mostly money laundering, breach of trust, computer crimes. So it's kind of the same crimes that you were seeing before with Alec. Interestingly, though, Corey did not have any money, apparently, at the time that this was happening. So I guess that goes to motive. Why would he have taken part in this, allegedly?
To get paid.
To get paid, exactly.
So what you're thinking, Liz, is that this guy has been pulling these kind of scams for a long time, that he's been linked up with the Murdochs for a long time, that these cases where he's taking on clients ostensibly representing their best interests, that the whole time he's just there to either help Alec Murdoch rip them off or protect Alec Murdoch and his family from the consequences of their actions. Is that what we're looking at here?
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, I would say this. I have questions. We did a really comprehensive piece, you, Mandy, me, that we published yesterday when it became clear that he had been indicted. And throughout it, you can see where where Connor Cook pops up in history in Beaver County and surrounding areas and sort of, you know, just questionable areas. So once you see it all together, you know, as we did on one page in one story, and you see beat for beat sort of where he has inserted himself or where he's been. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, one of the points that we made was that in 2008, there was a couple that went missing in Hilton Head, and it is one of the most notorious cases in Hilton Head.
Still unsolved, isn't it?
Yeah, still unsolved. And, you know, of course, the guy who, you know, law enforcement thinks did it, he killed himself in a bathtub, and for years afterward, and even to this day, people believe that that was not actually a suicide, and that there was a lot of shady things involved there, and a lot of similarities. You're talking about a lot of money being embezzled. That was what was at the root of the Calvert's case. Mm-hmm. You're talking about an import-export element.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Calvert's case, you have rumors of Russian mafia involvement. Kazakhstan, I believe, was a country in question there. You don't often see that. But yeah, there's an import-export element to it that supposedly Garwing was involved and got caught up in over his head with car exporters. So yeah, there's a lot of intrigue, a lot of weird characters, all that stuff. But guess who pops up again? It's Corey Fleming. He is Gerwing's attorney, and Garwing is the guy in the bathtub. So
guy who allegedly killed himself.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Allegedly killed himself. So yeah, I think it was really shocking for people to remember that and to be like, because back in 2008, you know, Beaver County is interesting because it is split by the Broad River. So it's almost like you have two counties in one. You have the south of the Broad and the north of the Broad.
Mm-hmm.
South of the Broad is a lot of people from somewhere else. North of the Broad is a lot of Southerners and people from somewhere else. But for the most part, you sort of look at them separately. So lawyers on Hilton Head usually do Hilton Head. Lawyers in Beaver usually do Beaver, that kind of thing. So when Corey came onto the scene, you know, there was a question because it was like, well, what's this guy doing down?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but how do you cross the river? What's he doing down here? So no one really, I think a lot of people were surprised to remember that that actually was Corey. So it was one of the cases that was weird. He only served as his lawyer for about a week for obvious reasons. That was one of the cases. And then there was another very controversial story with our clerk of court at the time in 2009. Mm-hmm. She and her husband got caught up. She was caught embezzling. And she was brought up on state and federal charges and found guilty or pleaded guilty to both and got no time in jail or prison. But Corey was involved in that in the sense that what was at the heart of it was this nonprofit that had been set up to run the county's drug court. And you know, that is very unorthodox because usually drug courts are run through solicitors' offices. So, you know, you have this weird nonprofit. He's this judge who's paying himself a salary from it. He's getting, you know, lobbying money from municipalities and such. And look who's here again. Corey Fleming is on the board of directors. And I spoke with a former board member today, or somebody who was listed as a board member of that nonprofit. And she said that she had only gone to one meeting. She thought it was a charity, realized it was something different, and never went back again. And yet she's listed in their nonprofit filings as a board member. So it just shows you there's some like weird stuff happening there. That got shut down, obviously, when the embezzlement stuff came out. But again, another weird thing, another unorthodox thing, another, the embezzlement word is there yet again. And there he is. He's like the Where's Waldo of, you know, of alleged scam artists, I guess.
Sounds like everything shady in this county over the last, you know, 2 decades revolves around this guy.
All right, another Murdoch-related news. We've got an update this week on the jailhouse calls, the legal drama surrounding those calls. And in an interesting turn of events, we had a lawyer for Richland County, for the jail where Alec Murdoch is being held, a guy who really, his client isn't even really a party to this action, but he filed a very impressive brief arguing that the jailhouse calls absolutely should be released and that Alec Murdoch's lawyers, Dick Harpootlin and Jim Griffin, who we were just talking about, have no business trying to keep those from the public. Liz, you covered this issue for us. Tell us a little bit about this filing that was filed by Richland County.
Well, I'll say never in my life did I ever expect to see a county government come out so strongly for FOIA, especially not in South Carolina. So I commend that attorney. It was great. And yeah, I mean, we know from talking to people that, you know, generally speaking, everyone thinks that the lawsuit that Dick and Jim filed was, you know, meritless. And obviously there were a lot of material mistakes that they made in even filing it. And one of the things that the lawyer pointed out in his brief that we pointed out weeks ago was that Dick and Jim used a 1976, I believe, case law to prove, to support their case, saying that this shows that this should not be made public, absolutely leaving out the fact that in, I think it was 2001 or 2003, something in there, that there was a case called Smith versus the United States, and he sued for the right to his jailhouse recordings, and he got them because they were determined to be public information. So it is absolutely stunning, but I think, you know, you and I can both agree, more stunning than that is that the South Carolina Press Association, of which I was a longtime member and have won many of their awards.
That's right.
You know, they've been really oddly silent on this, and as have been our colleagues.
That's right. A lot of the mainstream media outlets that have been scooped on this story from the very beginning, nowhere to be found on this debate. Now, they have submitted their own FOIAs after Liz here scooped them. She was the one that filed the FOIAs in her capacity as executive editor at Fitz News and co-host of the Murdoch Murders podcast. She had the bright idea to do it. Now they've all got the idea to do it, but you raise a really good point. And this is something that kind of pisses me off because, again, it's not just us. It's not about us. I mean, this is Transparency Week in South Carolina, people. This is about your access to your records. This is your money. You pay for this facility. You pay for these phone lines. And frankly, this is a high-profile case involving theft and institutional corruption at a huge level. So don't you have a right to know what's going through the minds of some of the people that are at the very center of it? We think so.
We think so. And I would add this. I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, this isn't a situation where we're just like, oh, it would be fun to hear those calls. These calls were referenced heavily in a January memo in opposition to Alec's bond reconsideration. And as it turns out, the arguments that Dick and Jim, you know, some of them that they were making in the interim, whether it was on national TV or to Judge Lee, these arguments were contradicted in a lot of the phone calls that we had gotten. So the phone calls that we had FOIA'd for, that idea was out there for anyone to have. I mean, they were mentioned in that hearing, they were mentioned in the memo. And wouldn't you want, I mean, it's more than, I think, you know, because there's some personal, it is uncomfortable to hear a father talking to his son in jail. It just is, no matter who you are. It is, you feel bad for it. You can have that emotional reaction. But the truth of the matter is that this is a group of people who have gotten away with a lot in 100 years of history in the Lowcountry. And so, of course, and he has two attorneys who are cunning. He has State Senator Harpootlian as his attorney, mm-hmm. who is very well connected. Yes, you as the public, I would think, would want to know that everything is above board that is happening in here. And of course, we find out there isn't. You know, we find out that there's money being paid to somebody in connection to Buster Murdoch's, you know,
his effort to get back into law school.
Yeah. And you hear that, and you hear that Alec is liberally breaking the rules while he is in jail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that whole underwear thing that was just so embarrassing during the January hearing turns out to not even be the excuse that Alec was giving for wanting to have money mm-hmm. put on another inmate's account. It was actually, he was telling people it was ibuprofen because he's so sore from all his jailhouse workouts. So, it speaks to one, you know, our colleagues obviously were like, oh, we better get those too. And that's great. They should have them. And I hope Richland County does give them whatever they're asking for. But the way they wrote about this story, because I think, you know, it's personal for them because it was us that got them. They don't want to have to, you know, admit that. So they refer to us, you know, generically or disparagingly, I think even in my opinion. But to see the way these were whitewashed, the content of these calls was whitewashed, like were whitewashed in the press, speaks to, as you said in your piece, which was brilliant and everyone should read it, that
you know, I'm brilliant.
You're brilliant.
What can I mean?
That day they were basically, you know, basically repeating the party line from Dick and Jim. So you can see the similarities between the two major newspapers in the state, just in the language and sort of the points that they made. And in fact, both of them, neither the Post and Courier nor the state attributed, they had one line, both of them, that was, it is rare to see jailhouse calls released.
Is BS. It's rare when people ask for
them. It's rare for people to ask for them. So, you know, cite your source on that. I would love to hear it. Or I can cite it for you. It's Dick and Jim.
That's what we're talking about, people. But yeah, real disappointing. You know, listen, again, it's not about us. It's not about them. It's about your access to your information. Again, it's your records. You pay for them. And again, they are relevant to a very high profile criminal investigation, one involving a double homicide, repeated attempts to obstruct justice. Yeah. So it does matter. And again, I would challenge not only the South Carolina Press Association, but our other colleagues in the mainstream press who are, by the way, just last weekend receiving awards for breaking news on the Murdoch story, which is a story they didn't break. I hate to break it to them, but they didn't break that story.
I can actually interject on that because I wasn't working for Fitz News at the time, and I was the source on that information. I gave the information to Will. Actually, I gave it to Mandy, and she was in Puerto Rico. So when I didn't hear back from her, I texted you. It was like 6 o'clock in the morning or something when you texted me back, and you got it up. And then I texted the information to Case and Bayless at the Island Packet. Because for me at the time, I mean, the only thing I cared about was that this story get out there fast, because I had found out at about 1:30 in the morning, and I knew that the fix was going to be in, that it was going to start to get covered up. So it was, to me, it wasn't just about, you know, you and Mandy or my friends, and I wanted you guys to obviously have it, but I wanted the press to be all over this from the very beginning, because, you know, it is Transparency Week and sunshine is the best disinfectant. So I knew that these guys were going to work fast to divert attention from it, or worse, cover it up. And that was the point. So, yeah, I mean, they did, you know, they did break it for their paper, but I know the order in which that information came out. So
you do.
It is disingenuous.
Well, and just remember, if you want the talking points from the defense attorneys in this case, if you want regurgitated pablum from Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin, feel free to check out the postandcourier.com and thestate.com. They have got you covered on that front. If you actually want the breaking news on this story, if you actually want real analysis behind that breaking news, context, and most importantly, if you want a website that's going to stand up for the truth, stand up for the victims, come to Fitz News. Thanks.
So on a previous edition of Week in Review, I cracked a joke about how this show was addictive like fentanyl. And in retrospect, that might not have been the best joke, because earlier this month, the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control released updated overdose data showing a 105% spike over the last 7 years in fentanyl-related overdose deaths. Now, We published this information exclusively on Fitz News, but as I looked deeper into this issue, I felt like we needed updated information. Again, that was 2020 data that was released by South Carolina's health agency. I felt like we needed to get some updated information. So I reached out to an agency that is following this issue very closely, which is dealing with this issue on a daily basis, the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division. Now, not only does SLED conduct its own investigations and related to various drug rings, but it also provides support services for local jurisdictions, whether it's testing drugs, whether it's doing other support work for local municipalities and county governments on their drug-related investigations. So we pulled some numbers. SLED was very kind to provide us with some new data, and I wanted to pull some of these charts up. The first chart we're going to look at, this is a drug analysis of fentanyl items and cases. And if you look at this chart here, it's just unbelievable. Back in 2015, there were 60 different items containing fentanyl that were tested in SLED's labs or that SLED was involved with in supporting these local jurisdictions. Last year, 2021, 1,626. So they went from 60 to 1,626. Folks, I did the math. That is a 2,593% increase. That's right, 2,593% increase. Again, I cover a lot of news on FITS. We cover a lot of stories. We cover a lot of percentages up, percentages down. I've never seen one like that, ever. Let's keep going. This next chart we're looking at, these are post-mortem toxicology results. These are basically toxicologies done during autopsies of folks who have died from overdoses. And if, as you can see there, go back to 2014, there were 26 involving fentanyl back in 2014. Last year, 451. That, again, a 1,634% increase. Huge spike. Let's look at DUI toxicology cases. And again, these are not deaths, but these are people who are pulled over for driving under the influence. They get tested. Back in 2013, only 8 cases. Today, or rather last year, 149 cases. That is a 2,383% jump. Again, all across the board, folks, these are staggering increases, stunning increases, shocking increases, and they are emblematic of an epidemic. And the epidemic has a lot of sources. And in my article, I addressed a couple of those sources. The big problem, we've got an open border. We've got an open border on the southern border of this country. Drugs are pouring into this country right now, and synthetic opioids, particularly clandestinely manufactured fentanyl, is the biggest problem when it comes to that open border. So that's one of the issues we've got to address. And unfortunately, under the administration of current U.S. President Joe Biden, it is not being addressed. Drug seizures at the border are way down. And again, these only capture a small fraction of the drugs that are flowing into the country. But again, we're not even trying anymore. We're not even trying to secure that border. So that's one of the things that the folks I spoke with at multiple levels of law enforcement, local, state, and federal, they all told me this is a huge problem, the open border. But we got another problem, folks. It's not just the drug dealers on the streets or the cartel bosses that are running those dealers. We got another group of drug dealers that wear white lab coats, that are respectable, that give money to politicians, that are pillars of our community. They're people who unnecessarily prescribe opioids to patients for pain when they don't need them, when something less could get the job done. And again, this is a huge problem. And one of the things that we quoted in the article, I found a discussion from a professor up at Harvard University. This was a guy, Howard Koh, just last month gave an interview talking about the root causes of the opioid epidemic. And I wanted to read this quote because it really resonated with me. The profit motive of the pharmaceutical industry remains ever present. That was true when the opioid epidemic began several years ago. It is more true than ever now. And fentanyl, folks, fentanyl is a clear and present escalation of that epidemic. And not only fentanyl, we've got substances out there like carafentanil, up to 100 times stronger. I mean, you're talking about substances just beyond any comprehension, anything we've ever seen before. I'm a former drug addict too, people. I know how hard it is to quit this stuff once you start. I've written about that extensively on Fitz News. So as I look out at all the folks that are dealing with this, it truly is heartbreaking. But these new numbers, we published them exclusively earlier this week. I would encourage everyone to check that article out so you can see just how shocking these increases are, what a huge problem it is. But I would also encourage readers not only to just look at those numbers and digest them, but think about the broader issue and what we can do to help those who are in need. And for me, it starts with one thing, which is decriminalization, which is setting the free market to work, getting government out of the prohibition business so that we are able to regulate these substances through the private sector so that we know what people are getting, so that we don't have this black market out there where these substances are flowing in without any idea of their potency, of exactly what they're made of. Because the sources I'm speaking with in the treatment world, they're telling me that folks are coming in, they're snorting coke, but it's really fentanyl. They're shooting heroin, but it's really fentanyl. Even marijuana. One of my sources in Greenville told me it's in the weed in Greenville. So something to keep an eye on, and count on Fitz News to continue to keep you updated, not only on the latest statistics about this epidemic, but on the bigger debate on what to do about it. And so earlier this week, one of the biggest stories we broke at the South Carolina State House was the resignation, or rather the impending resignation, of South Carolina House Speaker Jay Lucas. Lucas is arguably the most powerful member of the South Carolina legislature. He's a lawmaker who's been there since 1999. He's been the Speaker of the House, which is the most powerful position in the House, since 2014, since December of that year. Lucas has been a compromiser. He's been one of those middle-of-the-road guys. He's not going to rock the boat, respected by his colleagues, but as far as a force for taxpayers, a force for liberty, a force for reform in government, not so much. Not so much. Now, Speaker Lucas is a friend of mine personally. In fact, we're in a fantasy baseball league together. And upon his formal resignation, I will be able to publish a photo that the two of us took together back in 2015 when he was forced to hand me the championship trophy for our fantasy baseball league. So I look forward to sharing that when he steps down. But as far as policy, he and I didn't really see eye to eye. In fact, I would say that Speaker Lucas, for all of his wonderful characteristics as a person, when it comes to his policies, I would say that he was basically a Democrat. Big government, higher taxes, and less liberty, which is unfortunate because South Carolina for the last few decades has elected Republicans thinking that they were going to get lower taxes and less government. Didn't work out that way. Speaker Lucas's decision, though, is important. It has prompted a full-scale power struggle, if you will, in the South Carolina House of Representatives as the totem pole shifts and as those who were below him on that pole begin clawing their way up in the hopes of improving their position. The first position that will be filled is obviously his, and that battle is over. That battle was over before it started. The next Speaker of the South Carolina House of Representatives will be Merle Smith from Sumter, South Carolina. In fact, my sources in the legislature tell me that Smith, who is currently the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, the panel that writes the budget each year, has more than 100 votes. And in a 124-vote chamber, that's pretty good, people. He's got it. The job is his. And so we will see Merle Smith as the next Speaker of the South Carolina House of Representatives in 2023. Now, after that, battle is on, people. We've got a fight to replace Smith on that key budget writing position we were just talking about. We've also got a fight for who's going to be the next majority leader in the South Carolina House of Representatives, because another one of the retirements that was announced earlier this week, Gary Simrell from Rock Hill, South Carolina, he is the current majority leader in the South Carolina House. Like Speaker Lucas, he announced that he is also not seeking another term in 2022. So a huge shakeup in the South Carolina House. You read about it exclusively on Fitz News earlier this week, and continue to follow our website for those of you who track the State House for the very latest on how that power struggle will shake out. All right. So last December, took the family down to Tybee Island, Georgia, which for those of you who are unfamiliar with Tybee Island, it is the entranceway to the port of Savannah, which is the busiest port in the Southeast. That's a title that used to belong to Charleston, South Carolina, but as my news outlet has chronicled extensively in recent years, a bunch of bumbling, bickering, politically appointed morons in charge of that facility have allowed Charleston to completely lose its competitive advantage. And by the way, a few years ago, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley absolutely backstabbed the state, struck a deal with the head of the Georgia Ports Authority to further erode our competitive advantage. Now, what did Nikki Haley get out of the deal? She got a speaking slot at the Republican National Convention. So think about that. Our port competitiveness materially eroded because former Governor Nikki Haley wanted a primetime speaking slot at the 2012 Republican National Convention. Again, another story for another day. But down in Savannah, which is once again kicking Charleston's ass thanks to these politicians that we've elected, I downloaded an app called Marine Traffic. And I downloaded it because it tracks marine vessels. It tracks the ships coming in and out of the various harbors. And my kids, one of whom you see right here, really like to watch these big ships. So the app would show me where the ships were so that we could predict when they would come by so the kids could all rush to the window and cram their faces up to the glass and yell at each other about who saw the ship first, right? But anyway, this app has come in handy over the last few months as I have tracked the shipping crisis, the backlog of containers off the coast of Charleston. And if you pull up the app, like I did yesterday, you'll see about two dozen ships anchored off the coast of Charleston. You go down to Savannah, there's only five or six anchored. What's the deal? What's the problem? Well, if you read the mainstream media, if you read the Charleston Post and Courier, which is basically a mouthpiece for the South Carolina Ports Authority, that bumbling, fumbling, stumbling, government-run bureaucracy that's currently in charge of our port, if you read that paper, that propaganda, they'll tell you it's a lack of warehouse space and a lack of space. They just don't have room for all the new volume. Well, guess what, folks? That's 100% grade A BS. We found out the real reason because we've got sources who know the real reason, the reason that the mainstream press won't tell you. And what did we find? What we found is actually the continuation of something we first reported on more than 3 years ago, which is a brewing labor dispute. And that labor dispute manifested itself a year ago in another story we exclusively reported, in a battle between South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson and the International Longshoremen's Association. Now, Wilson won that battle technically, arguing that the ILA, the union, and some of its corporate allies were conspiring unfairly to try to deny business to the Port of Charleston. But it's been sort of a Pyrrhic victory. There hasn't been much in the way of actual shipping increases coming to the terminal that's at the heart of this, which is the new Hugh Leatherman Terminal, a massive government-funded facility that basically is empty. They will send one or two ships there every so often, but when you pull up that Marine Traffic app and you look at the Wando Welch Terminal over there in the Mount Pleasant area, or if you look at the Union Pier, Columbus Street terminals down in downtown Charleston, those terminals are busy. There are ships there. They're offloading. But you go to the Leatherman Terminal, empty. So we dug into that union battle and we found that the union, the ILA, the International Longshoremen's Association, what they want is control over the big cranes, the ship-to-shore cranes. These are the big ones you see when you drive by the port, but also the rubber tire gantry trains, which are the ones that hover over the containers and basically put them on the trucks that go off the port facilities. So these are the heaviest equipment on the site, folks. These are the big lift machines on the port facilities. And what we discovered was that the union is trying to leverage this boycott, effective boycott of the Leatherman port to get control over those functions. Should they? Again, I'm not a big union guy. I don't support organized labor. I think there's a reason organized labor has been steadily declining in this country for decades. I don't support labor. But I will say this. The Ports Authority knew that this was a problem years ago, before they turned the first shovel of dirt
on that Leatherman facility. They knew this was going to happen. In fact, that's exactly what one of my insiders told me this past week. They knew this was going to happen before they turned the first shovel of dirt. So what can they do? Not much, because guess what, folks? You can legally obligate ships to go to that terminal, but you can't legally obligate workers to handle them expeditiously. And in fact, what I've heard is that the union will continue to discourage calls at the Leatherman terminal, and the ships that do show up there, they're going to be processed very slowly. And the shipping lines know not to mess with the unions either, because guess what? They control every other port in the country. So if these shipping lines send a ship to the Leatherman terminal and the unions get mad, they will take it out on them, not at Charleston, but at Savannah, at Norfolk, at Long Beach in California, and even up in New York. So there's serious consequences for the shipping lines that cross the union. And again, South Carolina, basically, like my source said, we are over a barrel. And once again, it's because the people who manage our ports didn't think this through. They didn't think this through. But if you want the full story on everything happening at South Carolina's port, check out Fitz News, where you will get the real story about what's happening, not the propaganda from the government agencies you see in the Post and Courier. So check out Fitz News for the full real story on what's happening at our port. I want to thank everybody for joining us again on the Week in Review. This is such a fun format. I'm starting to really dig it. We're still sort of putting it together, piecing it together, experimenting, putting different folks on it. But I love it. I'm having fun with it. Grateful to everyone who's watching. Our numbers are going up every week. More people are watching this format, which I love to see. And that reminds me, if you're an advertiser that wants to reach this growing audience, hook my girl Andrea up. She's waiting to hear from you. Andrea at Fitz News. Pop her an email. Andrea Holloway is our sales ad marketing director. Reach out to her. We will get you squared away. But for all of you clicking, watching, thank you very much for tuning in. We'll have another big week next week as the Murdoch murder saga continues to unfold. We've got more developments and fallout from the South Carolina State House. And Fitz News will continue to keep a track on all that. Plus, we've got more news from the big MAGAPALOOZA Trump rally that was in Florence, South Carolina. We went to that rally. We published three or four stories, a couple video interviews already from that rally, but we've got much more to come as the 2024 election season begins to heat up early in South Carolina. So stay tuned for all that, and thanks again for joining the Week in Review.